This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Wing and Tail Outdoors Podcast, your Northeast destination for hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation. I'm Chris, your host, and on this show, we break down the science, strategy, and real-world experience behind life in the woods and on the water. The goal is simple: to educate and empower the outdoor community to make informed, responsible decisions in the field. So grab your gear, tune in, and let's get after it. And always remember, success is just a commitment away. What's up, everyone? Thanks for tuning in to the Wing and Tail Outdoors Podcast. As I record today's intro, it is Monday, February 3rd. This will be airing on Thursday, February 25th. And if you're anywhere near where I live, you're looking outside and everything is white. Just as we thought things were warming up and spring was on its way, Mother Nature reared her head and said, not so fast, and dropped some more of this powdery stuff on top of us. Here in Northeastern PA, we didn't get all that much. We got about 6 inches of snow. Down in central PA, where my buddy Dave Hoy lives, I think he said he only got like 2 or 3 inches, nothing crazy. But where my parents live, you know, more towards the eastern coastline, they got absolutely smoked. My parents live in Bergen County, New Jersey. They got about 20 inches. They had about 20 inches this morning when I talked to my mom about around 9 o'clock, and it was still snowing. My cousin who lives down South Jersey, a little bit closer to the coast, he woke up to about 2 feet of snow this morning. And last I talked to him, it was still snowing. Something like 600,000 people or whatever are out of power at the moment. You know, so it kind of came out of nowhere. I don't really pay attention to the news, to be honest. So this could have been coming for a while and I didn't know about it. But to anybody who finds themselves in any kind of trouble with the snow and the weather and all that stuff, I really hope you find the solution quickly. And I'll keep you guys in my prayers. Now, on today's episode, we welcome back El Temechko of Vitalize Seed to talk about spring food plotting and frost seeding. Now, one of the things that really led me to wanting to talk to have this conversation with Al, as I drive to work every day, or my second job at the Hunter's Gallery, so 4 days a week, if you will, I drive down this one road that connects one main county road to the other main county road. And as I drive down this road, on both sides of the road, there are field after field after field after field of, last I saw, there were grasses that they planted for hay or whatever the case may be. Now, on one side of the road, it's just whatever grows up grows, and then they plant what they want in the summer, and then they hay it, and they just leave it fallow until the following year and do it again. On the right side of the road, however, it looks like they went and they planted a cover crop later in the fall to protect going through the winter. Now, what was really cool is as this snow hit, that first storm that we got a few weeks ago, and we ended up with close to 2 feet of snow here for that storm, what was really, really cool to see was, even though there's a 100-acre field here and an 80-acre field there and a 60-acre field over here, there was these one or two sections of field that were split by hedgerow where they had put these cover crops. And the deer were crossing every single field, literally almost a beeline, to get from where they were in the timber to where these cover crops were. And that's just a testament to how important it is for these animals, not just deer, but the animals in general, to have access to higher quality nutritious food in these higher stress periods. You know, you have this period now where it's really cold and the deer have to kind of work for their food. You know, you have the spring where the fawns are grow, where the fawns are born, and the doe really need to find good quality food to produce that good quality milk. You have the rut time, you know, where the deer are running rampant and they're being, especially the bucks, you know, they're really burning off a whole lot of body fat. All of those times of the year, it's really, really important for deer to have nutrients and access to nutritious food. But this time of year specifically, especially if you live in a place with high deer density, low woody browse availability and stuff like that, you know, so we, Al and I kind of dive into all of these things, how winter this year has affected what food is available for deer, how it could potentially impact frost eating and earlier season spring food plots, and how we want to look into working the Vitalize 1-2 system moving from now into fall. Just a quick recap, which we talked about this in the podcast a bit, but if you guys remember last year, we started with the Vitalize system and we decided not to go with the Nitro Boost. We decided to do some frost seeding and kind of get those clovers working and just the soil ready for the carbon load. And we looked at the carbon load as part one of the cycle. So this year we'll be bringing that cycle full circle, and we'll be planting that Nitro Boost in the summer. And we talked about how all of this is important in today's podcast in our system. Now, before we move into the body of this, we do talk a bit about our property, the property that my family manages. I do this for a reason, and that's because where we are right now, we're closer to the beginning stages. My soil is crap. We get stuff to grow, but it doesn't grow big and lush, versus being closer to the end goal of, you know, we got things growing 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet at a time. And, you know, it's green from end to end. And the truth is, if you're here consuming information on food plots, chances are you're closer to the beginning stages or the middle stages than you are to that end goal. So if there's any issues that I'm having, I'm sure that some of you are experiencing a lot of those same issues. You know, so being able to work through what's happening to me and the solutions to that, I feel like you, the viewer, the listener, can benefit from that if you are experiencing the same issues on your end as well. You know, and we want to keep it real, guys. You know, I'm not sitting here telling you that I plant these food plots and they grow up, you know, super green and super lush every year. Heck no. You know, I'm still working at this, but it's important to find the little victories as you go. And that's one of those big things that Al and I touch on in this episode as well. So before we get into it here, I'm just going to give some recognition to our partners and our supporters here. And as always, the links to all of their websites and all of the stuff that they offer is all at the bottom of the podcast description here. We have the Nested Tree Stand System. You can use code WT10 at checkout to save yourself 10%. We have Tooth of the Arrow Broadheads. You can also use code WT10 to save yourself 10% at checkout. Of course, we have Vitalize Seed, Fire Knock, Integrated Habitat Solutions, Truth Stick Custom Arrows, Rack Getter Sense, Hunt Arsenal, Silver Birch Archery Shop, and the Hunter's Gallery outdoor shop here in Hamlin, Pennsylvania. Again, if you guys are interested in any of those products, scroll down to the bottom. Just take a look at what they offer. You may find something that you didn't even know that they had or that you want to try out. With that said, I want to thank you guys so much for tuning in today. I hope you find some value out of today's podcast. And as always, remember, success is just a commitment away. Without further ado, Al Tomechko. Hey, how you doing, Al? Welcome back. How you doing today, buddy?
Good, man. Good to see you again, talk to you again, I guess face-to-face, you know, virtually, yeah. Whatever it might be. I know we've been texting pretty much all deer season and stuff off and on. And no, it's good to be back and chatting with you.
Yeah, man. Same here. You had a very successful season last year. I believe you you yourself got it done earlier, if I'm not mistaken. And then you had a mutual friend of ours come on in. I think he got the job done on your property as well too. So congratulations to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we had a good year. We had a really good year. We ended up killing, I think it was 6 does off the farm. Which was a lot of fun. I brought my cousin out. He's only shot, not only, but he's young. He's just turned 16. Mm-hmm. I think he's killed maybe 5 deer prior to that. Just hasn't had a ton of time in the stand. Like, he's hit pretty high success rate in hunting, but it's been fun to, like, I was like, okay, listen, his grandpa was out of town, actually. He normally sits with his grandpa, and I'm like, come with me. This will probably be the last year you'll be ready to kind of go out on your own a little bit, or, you know, with somebody near, but, like, let's get in a stand together. And I got to watch him shoot a doe, and it was just really fun. I mean, we hunted in the morning. It was kind of slow. And then, you know, that evening we had some does come from the direction, of course, we weren't expecting them to. And that was a little frustrating trying to shift around in the blind, because I had bought 400 Legend. I had a 450, but I had this brand new 400 Legend. I sighted it in. I had it on a bog death grip. I mean, it's just locked in, you know, and of course mm-hmm. the deer come from this, like, other side. So I'm trying to shift in this blind. I'm like trying to get over. I'm trying to decide, should I just pull the gun off? And, you know, and so we don't kill that deer, and I'm kind of sitting there sulking, and then look up, and actually he tapped me. And he's like, look, and there's like 6 or 7 does coming out of this thicket right into this big carbon load, which is our fall blind food plot. And I cranked the hammer back and opened the window, and I said, get on the gun. You know, and as soon as she turned broadside, I'm like, kill her now. And man, he made a perfect shot. It was just so exciting. And what was really neat is my good, good buddy was hunting a quarter mile away, maybe. And he actually shot a doe that evening also. So it was just really cool. I mean, we end up having 3 or 4 does in the freezer by the end of the, you know, couple days hunting, and it was a lot of fun. So yeah, we had a great year. Brian killed that hammer of a deer. He just got the tooth wear analysis back. That came back as a 5.5-year-old.
Oh, beautiful.
So yeah, we've been so lucky. I mean, we killed a 7.5-year-old last year.
Wow.
I was lucky to harvest that deer we called Dozer. And then Brian had killed a 4.5-year-old, just big, heavy-bodied 8-point. And then he killed that deer that was a 5.5-year-old. So in 2 years, I mean, it's been 3 really mature bucks, which is what we're striving for.
Sure. Oh, that's awesome. That's really great to hear. And it's really cool because, you know, anyone who follows your channel, anyone who follows the Vitalized Seed Network or whatever, they see the work that you put into it. You know, you're always out there, and not only are you putting in work for yourself, and obviously you reap the benefits and your family and your friends, but you're also trying to educate the community. Every time you're out there doing something for yourself, you also always make sure to share that with the community, along with some education as to what you're doing and why you're doing it. You know, so on behalf of anyone who pays attention to that, we want to thank you, because it really is important information. It really is.
I really appreciate that. I tend to be a little bit more detailed, I think, than maybe the average guy. And it's like, that's either a blessing or a curse, you know? And I try to look at it as a blessing, the things that keep me up at night. And probably don't bother some other people, but it's like, you know what, if I can use that to help educate people, or at least beyond what I've, you know, here's a learning curve I got, you know. A good example is, I hope you don't mind if I touch on it, is
absolutely,
you know, the drone survey that I did. I mean, Chris, that was absolutely eye-opening to me from a deer density perspective. So real fast, 30,000 foot view, you know, I had run, I don't remember. I wish I had wrote that down. Let's say 10 to 20 trail cameras.
Mm-hmm.
I put fresh bait down and I ran, because you can bait in Ohio, and I ran these mm-hmm. trail cameras, cell cameras, from 4 to 6 p.m. I tracked it, like, religiously for 17 nights. And when I got to the 17th night, went and did, ran averages. And I was very conservative. So, like, if I had two cameras 200 yards apart and it was 5:30 and I had three does in a field, and then there's no corn on that particular field, let's say it's just a food plot, and then mm-hmm. 10 minutes later, I have three does in front of where I had some corn put out or something like that, then I would just say, well, those are the same three. So I tried to be really conservative with my estimates. Mm-hmm. I came out on the nightly average was 14.5 antlerless does. And that's on around 400 acres. So I figured, okay, we're not, obviously cameras aren't covering everything. You know, it's a small snippet. So let's like double that. And then I think I assumed that the bucks were around half of that. So you're at like 55 total deer, 400 acres. When they flew the drone, so then I knew this drone was coming. Like, I think I ended my study, very loose, but my observations on like a Thursday, because I knew the drone was coming Friday or Saturday. And then the drone flew that morning and they counted 85 total deer on 400.
Wow.
So you know what? Not only was I off by trail camera data and even trying my best. So from the trail camera data to the highest number I ever had was 19 antlerless deer in one evening.
Mm-hmm.
They found 71 antlerless deer.
Wow. On your actual 400 acres?
Yes. Yes.
Insane. Wow.
So that puts your deer per square mile. And there's a whole bunch of variability that don't take this to the bank, because there's a whole bunch of variability depending on habitat. And that's why like the state of Ohio or any ODNR or DNR, I should say, is going to want to say, well, we want to run 6 square miles and really get an idea of deer density, because you're going to have these big peaks and valleys.
Mm-hmm.
But just in talking purposes, right? Like, I'm certainly not holding every deer around the farm. And that would put you close to 136 deer per square mile.
Yeah.
Which is really pretty high. And some people might say, oh, well, you know, button bucks are counted in that antler list, or maybe a buck was shed, or, but regardless of all of that, if you just look at it from like, okay, eventually your buck to doe ratio will kind of sort itself out, right? But like, you're not going to shoot subpar bucks, and you have a lot of deer, like the density, mm-hmm. regardless, is quite high, that you would need to almost shoot, well, 30 to 50% of that every year in does to keep the population from continuing to grow. That's a lot of work, you know? I mean, yeah. So anyhow, I shared that and documented that, and I've got really good responses. I actually just did another podcast, somebody, and that was the soil. I thought they wanted to talk soils and food plots, and they did, certainly. Mm-hmm. But their big driving factor was like, man, we thought that study was just really neat.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'll be honest, I called the drone operator, because I'm like, mm-hmm. There's an error. Like, that's how blown away I was. I was like, you have to be kidding me. And yeah, I mean, it was just, and I think the biggest thing there is I also overlay, so camera data and then hunting observation data every mm-hmm. year. Talk to neighbors, you know, we do all this. Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting is like, it's very easy in hill country, which is where our farm is, southeastern Ohio, to be hunting, let's say, on a food plot or a transition area that in between food plots or something, and see 3 or 4 deer, right? And it's pretty mm-hmm. common. You see 3 or 4, and then those are does. I'm not going to shoot a doe tonight or whatever. And then you look at your phone or you look at a bird or whatever, you get distracted and you look back and go, those deer came back. But what the drone survey really showed me is how, or, you know, diffusely spread out these deer can be in pockets. So like, you would see a group of 4 to 6 does, and then you'd go up, you know, 60 to 80 yards, and it'd be a little terrain feature, and you'd see another pocket of 4 to 7 more does. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go another 80 yards to the east, to the west, or to the north, or whatever, another direction, and there'd be another little terrain feature, and there'd be another pocket of 3 or 4 does. So like in one area, I didn't measure it on Onyx, I should, but it's probably like 35 acres. There was probably like 17 to 21 does in there.
Wow.
Now there's acreage of the farm that has at that snapshot in time too,
yeah,
right?
For sure. Yeah.
But it was really, really interesting because even through our best hunting observation, and we had days where we just didn't see a deer. Well, certainly hunts. I don't know if we had total days, but we had hunts where like we didn't see a deer, mm-hmm. you know? So I would tell anybody if it's legal in your state and you're interested, I don't want to get into the debates of if they're used not properly and all that. Obviously,
yeah.
like anything, if they're not used by the laws, like, well, that's not how they're meant to be used. But
yeah.
if it's legal from a deer density perspective for studying, man, I found it really interesting. Really,
sure.
really interesting.
No, what I find interesting as a math teacher, as a numbers guy, right, is you only collected data for 17 days and you are within 30 deer of your property. To me, that's pretty darn good. And I honestly believe that if you would have continued your study beyond the 17 days, you would have been closer. You would have started to get closer and closer and closer to that number, that 85 or 88 number. You know what I mean? So kudos to you for just taking something and running with it on a whim and coming out as close as you did, because that's impressive.
Well, and I have to give credit to people who've done similar studies in the past where, you know, I was able to take that number and say, okay, well, I know these cameras are missing a large portion yeah. of these deer, you know?
Of course.
So, and then, you know, I ran some ideas. I'm like, well, it's not like it's 6 o'clock that I don't get any more pictures. Like the cameras are just all night. And you, again, it's like the same thing you hear guys talk about it. Like it's the same four does that just keep coming back into this food plot, you know, and you're trying to distinguish, but unless they have like a unique mark, you know, mm-hmm. it's often yeah. difficult. And in nighttime pictures, so that's what another really interesting piece is. It's like, I'm not saying everybody needs to shoot does. Every property is different and every neighborhood is different. But I do think there's a lot of places in Ohio that I can speak to just from living here. Most of my life, I've lived in Northeast Ohio. I've lived in Southeast Ohio. And I've observed and hunted on all sorts of different properties. And I will say most places probably have more deer than what people think that they have.
For sure. You know, and one of the things that we use on our property, you know, I've kind of taken on the role as property manager, right? And I try to do the best I can with saying, okay, this is how many doe I think we have, and this is how many doe we should aim to shoot this year, you know, because we know which neighbors are going to shoot antlerless and we know which neighbors aren't going to shoot antlerless, you know, and we have a good idea of, you know, between my dad, my brother, and myself, if we each take one doe a year, At least we're starting to work towards that goal, right? And I would assume, based on, we have some neighbors, even though we're not supposed to, we have some neighbors that put food out for the deer in the winter because we don't have mass producing trees. Like All right. We've talked about this before. In our forest, there's not a single oak tree for miles in any direction. The beech trees in our forest don't produce beech nuts. You know, so when you get into this time of year and there's and the deer are looking for something to eat, there's nothing there for them. You know, so when our neighbor is sending us pictures of a herd of deer on his pile of whatever food he's putting out, I could count 15, 20 doe, right? But when I'm out on a sit, I see more antlered deer, whether that's a spike or a forked horn or whatever. I personally see more antlered deer than I do doe on my property. Now, is that because the doe are off eating somewhere else when we're there? Or is it because there's just more, we have a lower buck to doe ratio? I don't really know the answer to that. You know, so it's really unfortunate that these drones are getting such a bad rap. And it really sucks that we're in a day and age where when something beneficial comes out, immediately we're thinking about how people are going to use it incorrectly versus talking more about how beneficial it can be. Because if we could bring a drone into our property and just hover it over, take a snapshot, like you're saying, land it and be done with it, that could be so beneficial, you know, not just to me, but to the other guys around me who also do their own form of property management or deer management or whatever, you know. So I definitely see the benefit of it, and I would like to try to focus on the benefit of it rather than hearing all about the negatives all the time. So I'm right there with
yeah. you. Yeah, I think deer density is just something that doesn't get talked about all that much. I mean, it is in like academia. If you follow, you know, MSU Deer Lab, like Dr. Bronson Strickland wrote the book, mm-hmm. Strategic Harvest Systems. I mean, wonderful book with Dr. Steve Damaris, and like they talk about it, but like for the average, you know, Joe, and I mean, we have amazing neighbors. They're great neighbors, but you know, some of them have a lot of acreage, yeah. and they'll be like, oh, we just don't see the number of deer that we used to, you know? And I'm like, you don't, you know? And not in a judgment way. They're just, yeah, and they might shoot like, you know, one doe on 700 combined acres. And it's like,
wow,
well, that's not really sustainable, right? And mm-hmm. you know, we've seen, you talk about beach. So we do a ton of TSI and we cut a whole bunch of beach. They're really a very, in Ohio, considered very low browse quality species, as in mm-hmm. deer are not going to browse them unless they're hungry. And I have beech stumps that are mineral stumping and they literally are eight. They look like a bonsai tree. Like they're eight down, unbelievable beech. Beech nut hickory. Wow. That's another one. People, all hickory deer aren't going to, you know, hickory's not good for anything but baseball bats. I've heard people say that and it always laugh. And I'm like, I have hickory that I had been marked by the forester to cut, and I cut them and fell them. And they're like, yeah, unfortunately with hickory, you know, deer don't really, it's not a preferred species. They don't really eat them, eating the snot out of them. So you take that in combination with 30 acres of food plots a year in combination, and that's annuals, then perennial food plots, observations, camera data, and then add that in talking to neighbors, and then add that layer of the drone technology. To sit back and go, hey, guys, you own your farm. You do whatever you want on it. That's why we live in the greatest country in the world. But I just want to let you know, I paid, you know, a few $100 to have this drone do a survey. Here's what I found. I don't think mm-hmm. I'm holding every deer in the neighborhood. So if y'all want to eat some backstrap and maybe make some chili or some smokies or some jerky and enjoy, like, I don't think you're hurting anything. And I think that's like the true nature of hunters in general, is just for conservation. Hearted, not mm-hmm. just minded. I mean, it's a feeling in your heart of like, I think even the average Joe hunter who just goes out and wants to hunt, they're like, man, do I want to shoot a doe? I just like seeing deer. You know, they're so concerned about the deer and the deer not. It almost can be, in some cases, again, not blanket, but in some cases, I think it can be a detriment to the deer themselves and also the surrounding habitat, right? For sure. I know for me, it's always a balance. I mean, listen, I'll end this on this so it doesn't get too long-winded, but like, it's a lot of work. Like, it is a lot of work because stuff goes wrong. I mean, we had times this year, my cousin, he's at full draw, doe needs to take one more step. She turns, goes the other direction, runs out of light. She comes back by him, but he's like, dude, it was so low light. I'm not taking, you know. We had another buddy get to a tree stand to straps had broken. I would replace them like a year ago. So he's like, I just made a little ground blind. All these does start coming into the food plot. He's like, ready to shoot them. He made like this great little tucked in blind. They must have got the wind swirl, you know, bust. Just like little things like that, you know, where you have a day, you're like, hey, I got 3 days to hunt and it rains. And yep. deer just don't move, or, you know, so it's like, I think that's another thing that is, we set a goal every year, how many, you know, we would like to, and we pretty much miss it every year.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tough, especially on a property like yours, you know, for like, I'm managing 130 acres and don't get me wrong. I know that I'm naive if I say that, oh yeah, we can manage the herd on 130. You're not managing a herd on 130 acres, right? We could do our part. You know, but they're like, my dad is guilty of this, you know, or my brother even, you know, we'll go out hunting. Rifle season in New York runs from, Thanksgiving, I think, into the first, the week, the Saturday before Thanksgiving, I think, to the first Saturday in December. I could be a little wrong on that, right? But we'll go out rifle season, snow on the ground, 20 something degrees, and my dad will go, I'm not shooting a doe in this, you know? So it's like, and on one hand, I get it, you know? And on the other hand, I'm like, I'll help you take care of it. You know, I'll take the deer home and feed my family with it. I don't care, you know? But if my parents, my brother and my dad are saying that when we have a side-by-side to drive up to the deer and take it out of the woods with, I can only imagine, you know, what other people are saying that don't have that, you know? But just how you're saying things happen, you know, things can happen because of things that aren't in your control, like weather or a strap breaking or wind swirling at the last moment. Or you could be like me, where I just had a mental breakdown and made just the silliest mistake of all time. And I think this is a good segue into what we wanted, into the meat and potatoes of the conversation today, because you were talking about the deer that you shot being on some carbon load food plots. And I was fortunate enough to take my first deer ever on a carbon load food plot this year. Awesome. And as I'm, you know, I'm excited, man. You know, the last few years have been really crazy, you know, have been really tough for me between doing the food plots, trying to organize the family, you know, to get all this stuff done, between some bad shots that didn't end up the way that I wanted them to or whatever, you know. And the whole culmination of this, when I saw that dough go down, I was just over the moon, you know. So I'm texting people, and I'll be honest, I'm mid Instagram post. Right? I'm sitting in my tree. It's been like a half hour since I shot this deer. I'm mid Instagram post and I hear something cough. And I'm like, oh, those are those guys doing construction up, you know, up on the property above us. Next thing I know, I look up and our target 8-pointer is walking right through the only shot window that I have. And I never got a shot. I couldn't maneuver the way I needed to. I could have tried to force it through some trees, but I didn't want to. Now, yeah. fast forward a couple of weeks, my dad ends up taking that deer on the other carbon load food plot, you know? So it was like this whole big full circle. But what was really cool to see was just to give the listeners a little bit of a recap, our property is in the early stages. We're still in the building soil, getting our food plots ready to go. And if you remember from the last time we talked, my goal is to try to put as little to no lime or fertilizer as possible, because we just can't afford the amount of fertilizer it takes every year. You know, we talked and we said, it's possible to do it. You just have to curb your expectations and know that it's going to take a little bit longer to get there, but we can get you there. Right. So I go into this season with this in mind. And as I'm sitting there on this beautiful sunny day, you know, food plot growing, the grasses were growing, our tubers were maybe a golf ball size, you know, so they weren't huge. And I'm watching both the doe and this buck that I couldn't get a shot at rip these tubers out of the ground and munch on them, you know? And it was just really cool how, like, it doesn't need to be perfect for it to be successful or for it to have the draw that you need, at least in season. I'll be honest, you know, as winter is hit and the snow is on the ground, you know, I don't think we had that biomass, as much biomass as we needed to really hold us into the winter. But again, that's no detriment to anything other than we don't have the inputs to put in. And this is part of the growing pains, right? Yeah. So with that being said, that's kind of where I would like to start our conversation today on food plots. You know, right now we're in the frost seeding time of the year, or at least thinking about it. Anyone who follows your page knows that you were out frost seeding this past week, you know, and I got to be honest, man, I was jealous because your walk, you could see grass and dirt and soil and, you know, and I still, we're white as far as the eye can see on our cameras, you know?
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about why you chose to frost seed now, even though you could potentially have more snow.
Yeah. I mean, we probably will get more snow. Actually, we did last night, I guess it was, but it was like 55 degrees. So that ground was like soft, almost a little bit softer than I'd like. And I just felt like it was a really good window. So my thought on frost seeding is always the later you can wait when you're still getting those freeze thaw cycles, the better, only because you just reduce predation, runoff, all those things. Mm-hmm. But the caveat to that is always time. So like you, you know, I have a young family. I'm very, very busy with both Vitalize and other things too. So for me, it's like I had some time. I'm like, you know what? The conditions are good. We're actually going, it was like 50 or 55, I can't recall. And it was dropping to like into the 20s over the next couple of days with some snow coming. So I'm like, by the time that snow melts off, relatively flat area that I was doing in that video, like, by the time that snow melts off, that seed should be pulled down into the soil because, again, that it was an area that was recently cleared. I already had some clover and oats in there from the fall. So there's not as high of an erosion risk there than, say, if I was doing it on the side of a hill or doing it directly into snow. You're not sure, is it even going to get down through all the way? Or if we get a fast melt off, is it going to take off, you know, be in the Ohio River, right? So those are some things as to what I look for. But if you can wait, yeah, I mean, you can go all the way into, gosh, in your area, you might be end of March, you know, doing a frost seeding deal. It really just depends on what does the forecast look like. I'm not a big fan of putting it onto the snow. I mean, people say it works. I just personally think there's a little bit more risk there. Mm-hmm. It's because if you get a fast melt off, it could potentially carry that seed with it. But if you do it beforehand, and you're getting that freeze thaw and then some snow, not nearly as concerned.
Right. So your recommendation would be, if you're going to frost seed, be able to at least see the soil, but when you're going to do the frost seeding.
Yeah, I like to. I do.
Okay. Yeah, because our, you know, this might be important for the listeners to know, like our property, our food plots, you've seen them. There's maybe one or two that is kind of flat. The rest of them have some kind of grade to them, some steeper than others. So for us to go out and frost seed in the snow, I guarantee you when that snow starts to melt, it's going to be gone. You know, so for us, it makes no sense to frost seed if there's snow on the ground. It's definitely better to see some soil and then go ahead and put it down. And honestly, like you're saying, I would hope that it would snow because then it would protect us. We have a really nice turkey flock on our property, and they just eat every time I seed, they're there every single time, you know. Yes. So if I'm able to get in there knowing the snow is coming and frost seed ahead of that snow, I think that would really benefit us.
Yeah, well, and anything you can do prior to planning to frost seed, example, having a cover crop. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you're seeding, like I was in that video, I had clover, chicory, and oats in that plot last fall. Well, you're heavily reducing your erosion risk, right? Because there's living roots growing versus like if you just, even if there's some contour, but you have cover crops growing, there's roots. I mean, the soil's not going to want to just wash away. Mm-hmm. Now, you could still theoretically lose some clover seed, but you just think about it. I mean, it's going to be harder for that clover seed to get by all these other plants.
Yeah.
Whereas, if it's bare soil, or it was tilled, and like let's say you had a monoculture of brassicas and it's on a little bit of a slope and you tilled it and the deer ate the snot out of it. And now it's just kind of like rotting brassica and there's not really anything else coming up. There's no rye, there's no wheat, there's no clovers. It's just this field. And you go and throw a bunch of clover seed down and then get a real hard rain or a real fast thaw, those could be potentially higher risk of losing a lot of seed plus a lot of topsoil. So anything you can do to set yourself up in a right position going forward or prior to wanting to frost seed the following year, I think will help you going forward.
For sure. The way I think of it is, you know, I used to watch Gold Rush a lot on TV back in the day, right? And, you know, when they would hand sift, you know, whatever, they would scoop it out, the soil or whatever, and they would hand sift through it. That's the way I think of frost seeding or having seed and running water, you know, on a, like you're saying, like a plot that has some residue or you know, some overwintering stuff coming in or cover crop versus nothing. That cover crop works as those ridges that are in those sifting pans and helps to hold that seed in place versus just having a flat, solid soil surface to just let it run off.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So with all the snow that we've gotten this year, because there are parts of this country that saw snow this year that haven't seen snow in decades. So does having this much snow cause any type of problems for frost seeding or spring food plots, whether it's for the success rate of the food plot or the timing of the seeding?
You know, I think the biggest thing to be cognizant of is paction, ruts, things like that. Like, so I was going to do some frost seeding last week on a different place. And when I got there, I'm like, it's just too wet, you know? And if I go jump on the four wheeler and use a, you know, a drag spreader or even like one that's mounted, I would have caused a lot of rutting and pushing the soil down and causing compaction, maybe more short term, but that would be my big thing. I don't think that you're going to see where the snow has some huge negative impact on like your soil profile or nutrient profile or anything like that. As far as spring planting goes, I also don't think it's going to have a major impact on that. I mean, I think by mid-May, you know, we're all going to be ready to rock and roll.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit earlier, you know, depending again on what does this warm up look like or just stay colder longer. So the things to me that would be like, don't rush it. If it's real soggy, I mean, I definitely wouldn't get a tractor or something out there because again, you don't want compaction. And then the other thing I would say is just wait for the soil temperatures when it comes to actually planting like a nitro boost, which is our spring summer mix. Wait till the soil temperatures are in that 50, 55 climbing range because of the forecast. You know, don't go out there and try to frost seed that or something like that. You really want to make sure the species in which you're using are meant for that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And we've talked about this before. That's the problem that we have. I can't bring a tractor, our side-by-side into our food plots until the end of June or July. It really is that wet. And then it's crazy how our property goes from such extremes, right? So as that, we're up in the mountains, so we get a really deep freeze. Like our soil freezes hard. So as that thaw happens on top of the snow melting, then the ice thawing, you know, we go from being sogging, sopping wet in our plots to when you get into August and you have some of those droughtier or drier weeks come through where all of a sudden our soil is like rock hard in certain places, you know? So we really do go from one extreme to the next at times. And I find that it makes it very difficult to figure out a plan that works for both, you know, because obviously with the harder soil, you want, you know, tubers and stuff that can break up that compaction. But at the same time, those things don't grow in the wet soil, you know, so it's kind of like a catch 22 at times for us.
Yeah. And I think you'll notice some of that will get better as you get better soil porosity and things. And that's why I always am careful to say like what will happen, because it's going to be really situational dependent, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that does get better both throughout. I apologize for yawning. Anybody who has young kids gets it, you know, but
I'm right there with you, man.
Yeah. I will say that as you build your soil up and you get that better soil aggregation and porosity, you will start to see some of these things become, you know, drainage becomes better. And even the success of the growing during the growing season with limited rainfall, you're able to get more out of it just because you have better soil aggregation, you're getting that water infiltration. So it kind of goes both ways, right? But it takes time, specifically in food plots and fields and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's something that you're going to start to notice more and more as you did this year. Like, yeah, these plots are awesome, you know, and we're just getting started kind of what needs to be done. So I think that's something to look forward to.
For sure. And I will say this, you know, we went again from super wet to super dry. And if it wasn't for the duff that we had, leftover stuff. We had plans on getting a crimper this year. It ended up not working out. So the way I've been doing it is I spray the stuff standing, and then, you know, like a week or two later after the stuff is dead, but the new stuff hasn't really come up like really strong yet, I go over and drive over it with the ATV, you know, so that way at least the stuff is dead. It knocks it down. It's protecting the soil. And if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have even had the plots that we had this year with the drier weather that we had in August, you know? So to anyone who's listening to this, even if you choose to not do a true no-till system, anything that you could get to cover your soil is going to benefit you, as long as it's not like that weed mat that things can't grow through. You know what I mean? As long as you're putting something on that soil to protect it from the sun, it can only help you. I can't really hurt you. I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong there, but.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, we have seen it so many times with drought conditions and in how anything to conserve moisture in a thatch layer is so important with that. I mean, it's such a critical importance to retaining moisture and acting as a sponge and keeping the moisture that does fall. I mean, it's just so critical. So I absolutely agree with you. And I think that's a big starting point for a lot of people is how do I get that first growing season in so that I have a thatch to lay down?
Yeah.
Especially if it's cleared timber, it's not like an old CRP field or something like that.
No, I hear you. And then, you know, even if you guys are starting year one, if you have the ability to get it done, you know, go buy a couple bales of hay from a neighbor. Is it going to take a lot more work to go out and spread it? Of course, it's going to take a little bit of work, but it's sweat equity that is just paying forward your success a year or two or three down the road. You know what I mean? So if I'm not mistaken, hay isn't exactly the craziest expensive thing, you know, and it's readily available for you. The last thing I want to talk about here before we get into a little bit more of that, what the frost seeding looks like after it starts to come up into that the warmer season planting. What should people be thinking about soil testing at this point? Because, and I'll be honest, this is a little bit of a selfish question because we didn't take a soil test, right? And I've been in touch with Dave Hoy of Integrated Habitat Solutions. You're in close contact with him.
Yeah.
He really is. You know, we were talking this year and he's like, you know what? Even if you can't get the fertilizer and the lime, he's like, let's pull a soil test and just see where you are. Just so at least we have an idea of what we're working with. And if what you did put down 2 or 3 years ago did anything. And I was like, you know what? That's a great idea. And then I was like, crap, I should have done that in the fall, you know? So if people are just now realizing, you know, maybe I should get a soil test. Obviously they can't do it while the soil's frozen, or if they can, please share how they can. But what would the next best thing be?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you can get a probe in, I mean, ideally you would have a soil probe. You know, you can use a shovel and stuff, but for consistency purposes, a soil probe is really the best. You want a soil or sample, excuse me, similar depth every time. And I go as far as even marking GPS coordinates on Onyx. So when I go to a field, I go to the same three or four locations. I take three or four probes around that GPS location, put that all into one bucket, mix it up, and then put that into a bag and then ship it to Ward Labs. So as far as like timing goes, you don't have to really worry, especially for food plots or like lawn care. I mean, if you're concerned like with row crop agriculture, that's another discussion. We want to kind of know like, okay, and even then we can do a lot with a good soil test just because there's so many data points out there. But when it comes to like a soil test for most food plotters, the main goal we want to look for is like, where's our starting baseline and how, if we need to amend this soil, where and what makes the most sense so that we're adding amendments that don't cause antagonisms that are going to cause greater issues down the line. So a common one I see is, man, I got a good pH, just stuff's not growing how I want it to, and the soil's super compacted, I'm giving up on no-till, right? Or something along those lines. And I'll look at a soil test and I'm like, wow, your magnesium base saturation's through the roof. You must have only applied dolomite limestone. And then they'll say, oh yeah, I think I did. That's what they had at the store and I put down so much and blah, blah, blah. Well, what ends up happening is then you have a calcium shortage. So magnesium and calcium are inversely correlated. So as magnesium goes up, calcium goes down and vice versa. So What ends up occurring is if you're only applying dolomite lime, even though there is a calcium element there, it's more heavy geared towards magnesium and you're not offsetting that with anything like a gypsum, it can create some issue. And that's just one example, right? There's a whole chart out there if you want to look it up that shows different antagonisms. But there's even things like where people say, in corn, for example, I need so many units of N. Well, a lot of good agronomists will say, yeah, but you better make sure that the sulfur matches. Because if you don't have the right, not matches, but is in right ratio, right? Because if you don't have sulfur, you're not going to get this protein synthesis within the plant. So essentially, you're not going to get this N response that you're looking for because you're low on sulfur. Another common one people refer to is phosphorus to zinc. So you don't have to remember all that. But in general, the idea is just to remember that there are synergistic and antagonistic relationships in soil. And as something goes up, something else goes down. So one, without a soil test, you're kind of just guessing. Like, oh, manure is great. Just put it on. Well, I tell people all the time, like, did you test your manure? Because how do you know that it's not loaded with weed seed? Are you 100% sure it's totally composted? Well, I've had people who put manure down and they test their soil and their pH is at like 6%. And I'm like, why are you putting 2 tons of manure down? And they're like, well, it's, you know, good nutrients, right? And I'm like, well, maybe, but you're already telling me that your soil is holding so much water. And now you're adding all of this manure, which is high organic matter. And we don't have a real way to cycle it. We're not doing anything to really build up the biology. You're just kind of putting manure down with like a bucket of a tractor. So again, it's kind of always like the poison's in the dose, you know, that old saying. It's kind of like that. Like, we don't, too much of a good thing isn't a good thing. And we also don't want to just blindly apply things. So when it comes to soil testing, I highly recommend we do it via Ward Labs on our website. It's a test is $25. And what we just changed on that is that instead, it used to be you buy it and then we mail it to you, Chris, you get this little bag and a sample sheet. And finally, it's like, you know, it's 2026. Most people have a Ziploc bag and people are like, I want it yesterday, you know? And now you buy it, you put your email address in there, we send you the downloadable file, you download sampling instructions, and then the other one's the submittal sheet. And then it says, you know, grab a Ziploc bag. Obviously, you don't want to grab anything that's dirty, you know, clear Ziploc bag or a paper bag. You put the soil in there, you fold it up, you follow the instructions, you mail it in, and you get a full analysis. So that's the thing, for $25, Ward is going to give you pH, organic matter, micronutrients, macronutrients, base saturations. So it's really critical because so many tests out there, people, oh, I only paid $7 at my local county extension, but they don't even give you organic matter sometimes.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind as well when you're doing those tests. And there's a lot of amazing labs out there also, but just keep that in mind as to what you're spending. You want to make sure if you're going to go through the hassle of doing soil tests, you might as well get the full picture.
For sure. Now, this
the Ward Labs test that you guys offer, is that also the one that takes your non, let me make sure that I'm wording this correctly. They do a test that is able to say, okay, you have this many nutrients readily available in your soil, but then also this many nutrients that aren't available yet, but will be because your plants are decomposing. What kind of test is that?
So I think what you're referring to is a total nutrient digest. A total nutrient digest is a test that they run that is, so they use a multitude of extraction methods, water extractable nitrogen. They'll use obviously acid extractions, DTPA and things like that to extract nutrients off the clay or, you know, the holding components of the soil. And they can tell you, hey, here's how much. But then they also are able to tell you biology. So living biology, microbes, as well as necromass, which is dead microbes. And what are they releasing? Their bodies are made of carbon and nitrogen, you know, as well. And they're releasing that back in to the soil. And obviously that can be a pretty large amount of nutrients. So that's a total nutrient digest. That would not be included on a standard test. They're pretty expensive. I've done them before. I don't recall how much they are, but we've just done them for some testing. But it's a really fascinating test to get done if anybody's interested in that, but that's not included on kind of the standard conventional test.
Okay, I got you. That's awesome. Now, one of the things that is so unique to our, I guess, elevation location of our property, and this is really why you and I spend a lot of time planning every year, is because we only have so much of a growing window. Now, anyone listening to this might say, yeah, everybody only has so much of a growing window, and I understand that. But to put it in perspective, our first frost date is October 1st, and we typically tend to have snow on the ground into May. So for us, the soil temperatures and all that stuff, it's a very, very tough balancing act that we have to pull to make sure that we're putting the stuff in the ground at a time where it could grow, but also where it has enough time to grow that, I say this loosely, that it makes it worthwhile to still plant, you know, something like a carbon load or a nitro boost. I apologize. But last year, the plan was we frost seeded, and then I went back in and feathered in a little bit more clover and chicory. And then I went in again and I feathered in some winter rye to kind of fill in the holes as we were waiting for that nitro boost to kind of take a hold with all that drought and everything going on. Now, this year we were talking and you said, I think you need to frost seed right away as soon as you can. And whenever the soil reaches, I think you said 55 degrees, you know, which is on the lower end, but still okay, that I could go ahead and plant that nitro boost. And even if it only gets to 80% maturity, that it's still beneficial than not plant compared to not planting a summer blend at all. Could you give a little bit of insight to the listeners who may be in the same position as I am, where they feel like they have to choose either a early season frost seeding plot or a warmer season plot?
Yeah. So I think the goal there is you always have to identify, you know, budget, time, constraints, you know, based on geography, right? All of those different things. And one of the things I will say is when you're doing these annual plots, so nitro boost in the spring, summer, carbon load in the fall, one of the things to keep in mind is try to keep those as like your annual plots. So what I don't like people to do, just because I don't want them to waste their money, is go in and say, oh, now I'm going to put the Vitalize Premium Clover Plus, I'm going to frost seed it on all my plots. That's fine if you have carbon load in there, but then I would plan on keeping that as a perennial for like at least 3 years, because, you know, it's not perennial clovers aren't cheap, and you're putting that down. So I wouldn't recommend then going in and spraying that and then planting another annual. However, what I started doing this about 2 years ago, I think, and I have some fields that get hammered by deer, as we talked about deer densities and things. And I'll go in with our annual clover mix, and I will frost seed it into carbon load fields that are either newer, so I just haven't had that time yet to build that soil up, or just heavily, heavily browsed. So if those two situations occur, then we are in a situation where I can then fill the gap, if you will, with those annual clovers. So those are my recommendations for people that are saying, hey, I wanna do this. Now, here's the other option that I have a lot of people do. Some people have short growing seasons, Minnesota, Northern New York, Maine. I mean, we have a lot of people who do both. They make it work. But some are like, I just don't know if I can, or I have the time, or the kids, or the carbon load's loaded with annual clovers. So you can go in there and plant it like you, and you're going to see in just a couple of months as everything melts off, you're going to start to see all those grains and clovers and even some of the brassicas that survived are going to start coming back and filling in. It's going to be really green. It's going to be like a solar panel of just green sunlight gathering plants. And if you had frost seed an annual clover in there as well, some people will leave that go all summer. They will leave that go all summer. They'll let it get tall. They'll let it get thick. They'll let it get nasty. The deer, the turkey, deer will bed in it. It'll be loaded with bees for the pollination of all those annual clovers, hairy vetch, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll go in and they'll kill it off in the fall again, and they'll plant carbon load right back into it.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a really good benefit there. Other people, like I mentioned, and kind of what you mentioned, even if you get 60 to 80% of the growth out of your nitro boost, because you plant it, say, mid-May, you're getting so much benefit from different root structures, from different root exudates, from different depth of root structure, that it's also still, I mean, it's still really beneficial. In southeastern Ohio, I mean, we have a little bit longer window, not drastically. Like our first frost is around the 10th to 15th of October.
Mm-hmm.
I plant around May 15th every year. And I plant my carbon load August 15th every year, give or take. In that window, I will have, well, last year we had some decent rains in the spring. I had 14 to 15 foot of some sorghum in Sudan that I was planting.
Whoa.
I mean, you talk biomass. I have a video, Chris, I'll send it to you, that I put. It's just a short little short on YouTube where I say I'm like planting green. I'm planting on this hill. It's kind of like a knob. And I'm trying to film behind me. It's not the greatest, but I was just trying to show that tractor is a 75 horsepower with a cab. So you're sitting pretty high. You know, it's not crazy big, but it's a decent sized tractor. And I mean, the stuff's above my head.
That's awesome.
And you can just see it laying down. And I did another video talking about understanding like thatch, you know, because we had a heavy dew that next morning, and I was showing how, you know, the thatch, I could just pull it apart and that seed is sitting down under there, and it's just, mm-hmm. you know, going to slowly decompose. Anyhow, those are some things to think about, that growth that can be put on. And as you get your soils better over time, it's just going to get better. Okay. I'll give you one more quick example.
Sure.
I believe in it so much that I use the Nitro Boost as walking rows for my garden. So I plant our nitro boost in there, and I'll have sorghum and Sudan and beans and peas and everything growing up in my garden. And when it gets about knee high to where it's a pain to walk through and pick all these tomatoes, I mow it with a push mower, the walking trails, and reseed it again. And what I've been able to do with that is just continue to build up the soil through all of these plants just continuously decomposing. And I'm only getting, like I said, you know, a foot and a half of height out of some of that sorghum Sudan, but I'm like, who cares? You know, because I know that it's doing good things for the soil.
Sure.
So you, there's a lot of different ways to do it. It doesn't always have to be just picture perfect what we see in a catalog or a magazine. Yeah.
And I think what makes it easy for me to continue on this process is we had the conversation again very early on where you need to curb your expectations and you need to kind of understand that based on how you want to do things, again, it's possible, but it's going to take a little bit more time and it's not going to be, you know, this linear path from where you are to this lush green food plot. It's going to take some time, you know? And for me, I've made it a point to focus on the little victories as we go versus, well, this isn't green from end to end. What a failure. You know, like I know not to expect that right away. So I look for, okay, where are we succeeding? And what can we do to take that from this little portion of the food plot or from this smaller plot and take it and incorporate it into the bigger one? Now, what we ended up doing last year was we actually did end up planting the Clover Plus, which ended up being the perennial, which we then went through and cut down or burned down because we were going to plant the carbon load. And our goal was to try to get that stuff to grow through the summer and then knock it down. Now, my question for you is, I can almost guarantee you we didn't get a full 100% kill. You know, so there's going to be some of those perennials coming back, whether it's the chicory or the clover. Are those things that we should be concerned about? Like I heard in the past that if you plant perennials with annuals, those perennials or annuals can compete with each other and they don't exactly, because they're both working on different cycles, right? So those annuals are trying to get the most amount of energy, the most amount of nutrients to explode up as fast as possible to reproduce and die, where the perennials are playing more of that long game where they're slowly building the nutrients and growing. So is there any issue with growing perennials and annuals together?
Not entirely. I mean, I think it just has to be the right ratios. You know, if you start to see the perennials just taking over, it's out of control, you can't maintain it, that's when you have to look at like, hey, a serious, you know, herbicide burn down, right? Like I need to, or tillage or something. You got to take care of it, right? But in general, no. I would say it's not something that you have to be overly concerned with. Probably more so people get concerned just because they want it to look really pretty.
Yeah.
But I don't concern myself with that too awful much.
Okay, cool. Now, last year when we went and feathered in that winter rye, I bought enough to make sure that I had some leftover seed for the spring. When it comes time for me to do my frost seeding and we go through, and this year we're going to use the annual clover mixture. When we go in to do that, should I also plan on frost seeding some of that rye in as well? Or should we wait to see how that clover and that clover takes and how the clover and chicory come back from next year and feather in for the rye? Now, mind you, just to put it in perspective, we don't have a lot of, some of the plots are going to have some leftover like residue. Other plots are not. So keep that in mind as you answer that question, if you can.
Yeah. So I don't mind you using the rye in the spring. You know, it might not put on as much biomass as you're used to like in the fall, because it hasn't went through the winter vernalization, but I wouldn't frost seed it. It's just too soft of a hole, you know, if you will, or seed cave, whatever the technical term is, to let that sit. And also it's going to feed a lot of turkeys and birds. So if you're going to do the rye, come back in once things start getting a little bit warmer and you have like a rain in the forecast or something like that, put it down. And then if you get a little bit of moisture on it, that stuff will pop.
Hey, fantastic, man. That's awesome. So what I'm hearing now is things are looking good. We had a positive season last year as far as food plotting are concerned. Going into this spring, we want to make sure that we try to do some frost seeding while, you know, that heaving and thawing is still happening, and plan on doing some perennial clovers then and following up with some winter rye as things warm up, and then obviously move into that nitro boost and into the carbon load. And I'm really excited because we're about to start year two of the cycle. You know, last year was that first cycle and we didn't even plant nitro boost last year. Last year we focused on getting stuff into the ground, getting the clover growing, just getting the soil protected, getting into the carbon, that carbon load with the intention of doing the nitro boost this year. So I'm really, really excited to get year two going and really get the full cycle in motion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm excited for you. I mean, it's been fun just to watch the journey up to this point. I mean, some of the content that you've put out has been really awesome. And obviously you gave us shout outs, but it's just been awesome to see your success, you know, in growing these plots that I know when we talked for the first time 2 years ago, you were quite frustrated with some of the things occurring and what was going on, and to see some of those really, you know, pretty lush looking food plots. I mean, it was really awesome to see. And, you know, some of the things to keep in mind is just, I always tell people, use a little exclusion fence so you can measure browse. You know, am I planting too much food, not enough food? You know, do I need to shoot more deer? Do I need to not shoot deer? Do I need, you know, what does that look like, right? So that's one thing. And then just seeding rates. You know, we all try to, anybody in the industry, you know, whether it's a lawn seed company to food plots to row crop farmers, I mean, everybody's trying to say, hey, here's a generalized rate per acre. But every situation is different. Every soil is different. You know, there's so much variability there. That take some notes, you know, say, hey, I put down 45 pounds of the nitro boost and that was perfect. Or, you know what, I think I'm going to go to 55 pounds. I noticed the deer really hammered this. Or similarly, man, I tripled the carbon load seed rate. I don't recommend that.
Yeah.
But man, it just seemed like mostly the grains and the clovers did well, but I didn't get the size of the brassicas I wanted. Well, that's because there's a large portion of brassicas in that mix and you probably put them too, you know, dense, right? The other thing I tell people is like when you're looking at perennials, because I like perennial clover patches, I try to plant those in areas that I'm not going to really be hunting. Wait, what? Why would you plant something you're not going to hunt? To take the pressure off of my other fields. So whether it's logging trails, logging roads, you know, small hillside that's an orchard that I'm not going to really get the tractor into, those are really my targets for like, let's feed deer with this. Put in an acre here and 3 acres here and 4 acres over here on areas that's the side of a pipeline plant those, frost seed them, whatever, drone seed them, whatever you want to do. Get those planted, let that clover feed deer. That way you can, on your food plots that you're really trying to get this 1-2 system going in, sometimes that can be helpful because then you just are giving the deer something else to eat while those other plants are getting established. And clover is still very attractive during most people's deer seasons. But I do think in the northern climates, you know, north of Mason-Dixon line, you do start to see a pretty sharp drop off come mid to late October. Deer will still eat it and they'll even paw through the snow for it. But you'll see a big uptick on those carbon load food plots, you know, the grains and the brassicas and things like that. So that'd be another tip. If you're looking like, how can I fit in the clover aspect to this? That would be my recommendation there.
Fantastic. Oh, we've been chatting for an hour here and I appreciate your time. And I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about Vitalize Seed, which obviously we've been sprinkling that in a little bit here or there. The Ward Labs, that's a more recent thing that you've begun to offer, I believe in the last year, if I'm not mistaken. I think last year you started offering a military discount as well, which I was really, really excited to see. Is there anything that you're offering this year that maybe you weren't offering last year, or anything to look forward to that maybe is that you expect to have available, you know, before the season?
Wow. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, we're constantly trying to find ways to give back, you know, so we do offer military and first responder discount. Just email myself, Albert at Vitalize, or Jared at VitalizeSeed.com, or Albert at VitalizeSeed.com, and we will send you that code. Some people send in their military ID. We appreciate that, but honestly, we don't think it's been taken advantage of to this point. So we try to just be like, I don't think somebody's going to lie, but, you know, yeah. Stolen valor hopefully won't be an issue. But we, you know, we do ask that you just send us an email. As far as what's new, yeah. So the Ward Labs, we've been offering for a while, but we didn't offer it in the format in which
That's right.
A downloadable format, which is going to speed things up for folks. We also are now offering, we have a frost seed bundle. So we added a bunch of bundles, lawn care, garden. As the business has grown, we've grown. So we're doing things with flower farming. I did it was called DirtCon. It was amazing with a good friends of mine who have a flower farming podcast. It was 1,000 of the flower farming guys and gals who were interested in growing flowers and in farming and interested in soil. And we did a whole thing on that, or with them, excuse me. How do I take care of my soil? How do I grow cover crops? So we've added bundles, not just for food plotters, but for other areas as well. So check that out because it's a good way to save. We added all three foliar nutrients. That was new towards the end of last year. So we have three new foliar nutrients that you can add to the mix, if you will, to spray onto your plants. We added a new seed mix, which is called Alfalfa Edge. It is 75% forage quality alfalfa. So one of the issues with a lot of alfalfa is it's more geared towards hay production, cattle production, things like that. And it gets really tall, really stemmy, needs perfect soils. So we wanted to find an alfalfa that'd be really good for maybe suboptimal soils and that will be able to be grazed by deer, browsed on by deer, and still continue to put on tonnage. So we found that. We're really happy with that. It's been selling crazy. People are frost seeding it. You can obviously plant it on its own as well. Let me see what else is new. Oh, we are offering two new pieces. One is soil fertility consults. So last year I started just kind of getting overwhelmed. I will help anybody look at a soil test and say, hey, here's high level what we need to do. Add some lime. That's no problem. But if you're looking for like full 2-3 page write out, print out, you know, have a 30 to an hour call and like, let's dive into how exactly these nutrients are being applied, how, when, where, why. That's brand new. So soil fertility consults are on the website. Oh, I know. I'm missing something. So we always offer free shipping. We're always adding things to the education tab. We're adding new distributors. David Hoy is one of them. The last thing is the rewards program. So I'm super, this was hard to get. I don't even want to admit how long this took me to figure out. But we added a rewards program. So again, not only are we offering free shipping, we ship same day or next day, free shipping. We get out the door quick. We ship a UPS, so you're getting it fast. On occasion, we'll ship, if it's like a single 6-pound bag of clover, we'll ship USPS, but almost always shipping UPS. And now you have a rewards program. So every order that you get, and if you follow us on Facebook, you just have to follow the prompts there, you get points. And then you can use those points for like, oh, sweet, I want to get whatever. I want to get a jug of Regen N, liquid amino acid N fertilizer. I'm going to use $50 off of this to get it to me, right? And you just apply that. It handles it all on the back end of our website. It's a really a neat thing and something that I'm super excited to offer.
That's awesome, man. I'm really glad to hear that. You know, because obviously you're in business to make money, right? Anyone who's in business is in business to make money. But it's really good to see you guys going beyond that, you know, and trying to give back to the people, trying to give back to your customers, and just whatever way you can, helping people find the success that they're looking for, you know. And I'll close up with this, because you said something there where it was like, if you want to call and talk about your soil and just a regular conversation real quick about, you know, that soil test or whatever. That is literally how you and I first made contact, I think 3 years ago now. You know, I called you about the soil test I had. I just wanted to talk to you about it. And you were like, absolutely no problem. Let's have a conversation, you know? And it is just slowly grown from there. But again, Al, I want to thank you for your time here. You know, I always look forward to having you on. We usually have you on twice a year now. We usually have you on before in advance of the spring food plots, and then again in advance of the fall food plots, you know? So I want to thank you for your insight and education and knowledge that you shared with us today. And I look forward to linking up again sometime in, you know, July or August, and talking about fall food plots and how things had gone for that summer stuff, man. As we wrap up here, where can, I know you gave your email there, but where can people find you or reach out to you if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, man. The contact us page, you got emails there. We have a chat feature on the website. We did have a glitch, so I apologize to anybody who got that fixed. So it's rocking and rolling. So you can go to the contact us page. You can text or call cell phones. There's emails on there. And then you can also send us, there's a contact form. You can do the chat or all social media, TikTok to YouTube to Facebook, Instagram. We're pretty much on all of it. So if you check us out there, and yeah, check out our, you know, our products page. There's a whole bunch of stuff on there too. You know, we have a natural amendment fertilizer, which is really no-till nurture. I think you used some of that last year. People have loved that product, and it's been going like that, and the micronutrients have been going like crazy. But like always, start with a soil test.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, last year we used the BioCharge, and I believe we used the Revive RX. No, the BioCharge and the No-Till Nurture. We used both of them, and we saw incredible results just shortly after that, you know. So with that being said, again, thank you so much for your time. Always love having you on. To the listeners, happy food plotting. And until next time, remember, success is just a commitment away. Have a great day.